the Go Gopher Podcast with Mike Grimm, episode number 46. I am Mike Grimm, voice of the Golden Gophers, and welcome back to the podcast. We have a special Rivalry Week Go Gopher Podcast for you this week as we look back on the Iowa game and look ahead to the Wisconsin game with Gophers guru Daniel House from gophersguru.com. He'll give us a deep dive into what went right, what went wrong, and then take a look at the keys to this week's upcoming game in Madison. And we'll go behind enemy lines. We have a great guest coming up, a Badger scouting report, and an update from their very outstanding play-by-play announcer, Matt LePay, who's been with the Badgers more than 30 years. We're thrilled to have him on the Go Gopher podcast this week. Matt is an 11-time Wisconsin Sportscaster of the Year and one of the very best in the country. Our Go Gopher podcast is presented by alumni-owned Sunbelt Business Advisors and True North Mergers and Acquisitions. If you're a business founder planning to exit your business, start by contacting Sunbelt Business Advisors and True North Mergers and Acquisitions. Sunbelt serves more businesses up to $5 million in revenue than anyone, and True North M&A serves companies with revenues up to $150 million. Get a confidential, no-cost, no-obligation business valuation started today. Make the most of your life's work. Visit sunbeltminnesota.com or tnma.com today. We're also glad to have Affinity Plus Federal Credit Union with us on the Go Gopher podcast. Affinity Plus has been a longtime Gopher supporter. Affinity Plus is more than just a financial institution. They support so many good causes, including Gopher Athletics, also a big-time supporter of Special Olympics Minnesota, and much more. You can find out more at affinityplus.org/gogophers. Our podcast is also sponsored by State Farm agent Tony Hoagland at ChamplinInsurance.com. He's a big Gopher fan. We invite you to subscribe to the Go Gopher podcast. You can go back and listen to Go Gopher podcasts from weeks gone by. Last week, for example, we talked with Minnesota linebacker Mariano Sorimarin, who once again lifted the curtain on Gopher football and gave us some great behind-the-scenes perspective. Please subscribe to the podcast. It's absolutely free to click that subscribe button and listen at any time. This week, it's episode 46. We have a Rivalry Week edition of the Go Gopher podcast. Gopher guru Daniel House and the voice of the Badgers, Matt LePay, both will be along. Batting leadoff, though, let's break it down right now with the Gopher guru. Here's our conversation with Daniel House. It's episode 46, the Go Gopher podcast. Our pleasure to welcome back to the podcast the Gopher guru from gophersguru.com, our buddy Daniel House. And Daniel, good to see you.
Grimm, good to see you. I know you're under the weather. You're down in your studio right now, so it's good to see you.
Yeah, man, I'm feeling fine, but they say I have to stay in, you know, so here we are. Hopefully, you know, by this weekend, I'll be good to go, and we'll have Gopher and Badger football on the radio, but appreciate your concern, man. You're the first guy that's asked how I'm feeling, so I appreciate that. Here's the deal. So the Gophers and Hawkeyes played a tight game on Saturday, and we're going to break it down here with Daniel House. And I wanted to ask you this first because I do think PJ is taking more heat than he probably should right now in terms of his conservative nature of that game. I didn't find it particularly that conservative when how well it was going on the ground. I think there are certainly second guesses. In fact, I would second guess something totally different. I thought they should have taken a few shots downfield with the young man, let him throw the football and see if he can't hit one big, because Iowa, while they don't give up big plays, part of why I think that is because nobody ever attempts big plays, because they're all scared they're going to make a mistake. And my philosophy is, if you're going to make a mistake, make it 50 yards downfield, not 3 yards downfield to have it return for a touchdown. Anyway, point being, the strategy against Iowa is either go all in and pass 55 times and try to get linebackers on running backs and tight ends on safeties and all that stuff, or do what PJ did and just beat them at their own game. And he was within 5 minutes and then again within 3 minutes of beating them at his own game. And the two things kind of that happened were mostly out of his control. I know they could have called other plays, but what are you going to do? So I want to ask you first, what was your thought on that? And feel free to disagree if you do, because that's the beauty of the podcast.
Well, it's just like we talked about after the Purdue game. There's always like 4 or 5 plays in a ball game that end up making a difference. And you look at what the win probability was before the Calikmanis interception, 74%. Right before the snap,
yeah,
interception occurs, drops all the way down to 26%. So that type of a swing there is just it tells you how valuable turnovers are and how they can swing a game, especially in that type of environment where it's cold. You got the wind when you're going to the west there. I mean, that impacted people's ability to score in that game going toward that end zone. So that factors into a lot of decisions that you have to make. I mean, you lost a combined 69% of win probability between Moe's fumble and Kelly Kamanis' interception. I was saying, I'm like, you know, if they review this thing and call it a touchdown, so be it.
It's better.
You know, there's 2:08 left on the clock. Yeah. You know, they're not able to bleed that thing down. It was a good thing PJ had a couple of timeouts available, unlike the first half, to be able to call a couple on defense to be able to even get the ball back to have a chance. I think that's the bigger thing I would say from the first half is, wrote about it on the website this week, just operational timeouts. I define those as like, you know, not being able to get lined up correctly, trying to make a decision on whether to go for it, to punt, you know, those types of things where you have to call a timeout for, you know, disorganization or something not going right, not having personnel in the field. I think one of them was they had 10 guys on defense. They had to call a timeout and burn it there at like the 1 yard line.
Right.
So not having those timeouts, I felt like sort of impacted the strategy at the end of the half in the 2 minute drill. You didn't have anything to really work with there.
Yeah. And I think too, and you and I have talked about this. I think coaches sometimes, and this isn't just PJ Fleck, like there was 50 seconds left. It wasn't like 8 seconds. Like you can run, even today on his coach's show, PJ said, you know, our plan was hope to get the first and then you can clock it and then you get two plays.
Correct.
And I'm like, well, 48 seconds, you don't need to clock anything. You can get three plays off. You can run the ball at least twice, and if you have an incomplete, it's fine. There's why waste it down there? Like 48 seconds is an eternity, basically, from the 12-yard line or wherever it was. So I probably, again, I love it that the result of the play matters more. So if the pass is incomplete, right?
Right. And it was the right design.
Yeah,
it was the right design. I mean, split zone flow, they built off of it. They've been using that a bit. He bluffs that backside block and leaks out. I mean, it's there.
He's open.
I don't know. I'm interested in the progression there. What's the progression of that play? You know, is there an alert there for when that backside defender crashes, you're letting the ball out? Because if that ball is completed, it's a touchdown, and nobody's even talking about that.
Yeah, I think in rewatching it last night, we're talking about the 3rd-and-1 play right before the missed field goal at halftime with around 50-ish seconds. Spanford is there. I think it was Benson maybe, the linebacker, the end bit. But Benson had to make a decision. He knew he was beat. Like he couldn't guard the guy. I don't even know if that was his assignment. You could see, and he just made the decision, well, I'm just going to go try to disrupt the passing lane. And I believe in rewatching it that was the factor that Ethan felt he didn't have a clean throw to make.
Mm-hmm.
It was a good decision. I don't know if that was by design, that like he's, well, I'm beat, so let's just go. And he did. He disrupted it, threw his hands up, and then Ethan came back to a secondary target. But I guess the interesting thing to me is if PJ on 3rd-and-1 there hands it off and Moe's stuff for a 1 yard loss, then people
Correct.
Are like, oh, so conservative. But now
Correct.
They go for play action when everyone knows they're going to run and it doesn't work. And people are like, well, they've been running it down their throat. Why wouldn't you hand it off? And even PJ on the radio show today said everyone in the building knew we were going to run on 3rd-and-1. So he called play action. Well, everyone knew like all through the 3rd and 4th quarter on 3rd and 3, you were going to run and you still got 7 or 8 yards every play. So there are no right answers. That's the thing. Everyone can look at it with the beauty of hindsight. Right. And so I don't blame the play call. I don't know if I'd go for it there or if I'd kick a field goal. I think, on 4th and 1 with 48 seconds or whatever it was, maybe I would have gone for it and tried to get a touchdown and go in with the lead, but there's something to be said for being even up after you're down 10-0 too. What did the chart say? Go for it on 4th and 1 there or kick?
Yeah, the chart said to go for it in that situation. It was like in the very interested category. I have like a somewhat interested category and a very interested. It was in the very interested. However, I believe that when you get that number, you have to blend the football instinct into that.
Yeah.
So for me, I'm looking at the game going, okay, you're not kicking into the wind here. Okay, you got the wind at your back. If you're able to execute, make the kick, you tie the game. It's basically a new game at halftime. So I felt like in the cold weather, you're not factoring that into it, the premium of the points, and still the wind swirls through that stadium. You know, it's kind of
saw it on the kick, right?
I know, and it's like goodness, it you know, your strategy, I feel like the I want to know what the strategy would have been if you had timeouts available there.
Yeah.
Because that whole sequence might have looked different leading into, maybe you're not even in that short yardage situation there where it's like, okay, now, you know, you can throw the ball over the middle, you can run the ball a little bit more on the drive. Maybe be more aggressive in that sense. But, you know, it's just, it comes back to those. You're going to look back on this season, Grim, and go, there's just a handful, maybe 10 plays over the course of a couple of losses where if you're able to make those, you're probably looking totally different. I think the play that nobody's talking about is early on in the first quarter, I was 4th and 2. Oliver blitzes off the edge.
Hits him.
They hit that tight end delay there, and Petrus is just able to step away from it enough that, you know, if you can get a turnover on downs there, I believe a turnover on downs is just like a takeaway.
Yeah.
I mean, the shift in win probability, the shift in all the numbers that you look at there, the flow of the game, it's 3-0. You know, they're not able to get in the end zone there and get up 10-0. That play, I felt like if you were able to execute that there, you had a run at the quarterback. If you can make that play, it might have changed the flow of the game, I guess.
I 100% agree, because it's 3-0 at that point. You get good field position, and they're a tick away. I mean, they're just a tick away. Braylon Oliver hits him, and he still has the ball at contact. And for him to stand strong, Petrus, who hasn't been very good most of the year, and to make that throw, the Gophers, you know, boy, and I'll ask you later on about the tight end. I think it was 190 yards receiving to that position. They had, I think, about 90% of the total yards. It just has been that was the Penn State factor as well. The tight end has been a bit of a bugaboo for this defense that has been very good in just about every other aspect, including the play that set up the field goal to win it, that seam route right down the seam where they got the Gophers to bite a little bit on play action, and Petrus threw a strike, which he hasn't been throwing strikes. And against the Gophers, he does. And, I mean, look, there's so many different things. T-Time has the ball on his shoulder, and yet the ball sticks to Campbell's fingers like he's wearing Lester Hayes' stick-em, and he goes down the sideline. And even when it doesn't go right for Iowa, like that should have been a touchdown, it still benefits them, because had they scored, Minnesota, as you said, has two and a half minutes to try to at least tie it. But as it stood, you know, they call it back, they make the mistake, and then they hit the beautiful seam route and set up an inability to milk the clock. And then the fiasco at the end, where Brian Ferentz throws his headsets, and it looked to me like the ref was winding the clock. So you could see in the background, Brian Ferentz was saying, don't kick it yet. Don't kick it. They could have milked it down to nothing and kicked it with no time, which I don't know administratively if that's right. I don't know how Iowa would get 2 30-second play clocks out of that. But basically that's what was going to happen, because when they went to review the fumble, their play clock had basically got down to nothing. They were going to call a timeout. They didn't. They stopped it for review, and then they're going to restart the play clock. I don't think that administratively, if that's right, they got to change that rule. That would be unfair. Anyway, they were mad. They were throwing headsets. They get the timeout. His dad took the timeout, much to his chagrin, but they had already snapped it, so it didn't, you know, they weren't going to run time. Yeah. But all of that stuff, it's just weird how stuff like that happens. But I agree, the near sack makes, if it's 3-0, you get good field position. Who knows how it changes the game, and all kinds of different plays in there. Ibrahim, 800-plus carries, 3 fumbles in his entire career. And somehow on that play, what was the win percentage, Daniel, by the way, right before that play? It was a 3rd and 6.
It was pretty high. I think it was about 70%. Let me check it for you.
And on top of which, as you check, I'll just bring up some background on that. I think it was around 5 minutes or so, was it, or so when that when that fumble happened. And even if you kick,
so it was 70, it was around 71% at that point.
Yeah,
a 22% drop there in win percentage or win probability.
And then where was it? Did you 71 there, and then where was it on the interception?
It was 74.
Yeah, so about the same
for the interception.
Yeah, statistically, just about the same. I mean, what are the probabilities that a team would have two under 5 minute chances of 72% and 74% and lose the game outright in regulation in a tie game?
Well, you should see the win probability chart. It looks like the EKG of a Gopher fan watching the game.
A guy having a heart attack as Floyd of Rosedale is going to Iowa City for his eighth straight.
You see that spike, that maroon spike, and then it's like bang, it goes down, and you can see right where the catastrophic play happened. And that's what I said coming into the game. I thought two things would define it: whoever made the least amount of mistakes and won the field position battle would end up leaving there with the victory. I won the field position battle by 12 yards. They won the turnover battle 2-0. And you look at something I look at is expected points added, the total expected points added just on special teams. And you look at those numbers in the game in Iowa, they had a positive 1.69 total EPA. The Gophers were negative 9.25.
Yeah.
So that margin right there, it's sort of a way to look at complementary football. Like I kind of look at it through that lens, and I like to see which team wins that battle or keeps it relatively close. And I just felt like, man, everything was coming together. I thought when Mo was trying to get that first down, I thought, okay, they're wearing him down here. Just a couple more runs and just milk this thing down, and then, you know, take away. And, defense gets a stop. You got Terrell Smith with the ball. I mean, it would have been a tough play. He's sort of tripping, falling down, and he had a shot at an interception. You imagine a pick six there? Yeah, like,
well, or even if he catches and falls there, because he's also, I can't kind of breaking down to make the tackle on the running back, right? But if he does happen to snag it, it probably pops up to 80% win or higher now at that point, because you're closer and you're at a lower part of the clockwise and at a much better field position. So it's frustrating. I get it, and I know people want to scream and yell, but like I said, I thought there were two ways to try to win this game. One, do what Purdue does against them to win five straight before this year, and that's just throw it all over the field and hope you get matchups, and that's been a successful way at times over the years to beat Iowa. Or do what they did, and it dang near worked. I mean, the margin of error is thin, there's no doubt. To get 300 plus rushing yards and only get 10 points, to me, that's the other thing. Here's some homework for you, and maybe you have it. To me, these close games recently against Iowa, the biggest thing has been throughout most of PJ's tenure, when they get into the red zone, they're pretty good at scoring touchdowns. They don't kick a lot of field goals. They just don't, Minnesota. Right. Iowa, on the other hand, kicks all kinds of field goals. They stink in the red zone forever. In 2019, they led the country in field goals made. Keith Duncan was the kicker of the year because he had like 33 field goals in 12 games. But when the Gophers went down there, they had to settle for field goal attempts. Iowa scored touchdowns early. And so for whatever reason that Iowa defense does this to people, that when the field shrinks and they only have to guard 12 or 15 yards, and I'm not even saying go for it, like pass up on the field goal. I'm saying never get to the point where you have to kick a field goal. Score on second and third down somehow, or on first down. And they just, against Iowa, it's hard, and they haven't been able to do it. And it's crazy. To me, that's probably the biggest thing I would say in this series as to why they've struggled, because they missed a field goal in 2019. They missed a field goal down there last year. And just don't get to field goal attempts. Score touchdowns like you do every other game of the year. And that would be a huge difference.
Yeah, I thought that was a big factor as well, just being able to finish drives. Like, I like to look at how often teams, you know, are able to cross the opponent's 40-yard line. The Gophers were able to do it five times, came away with just 10 points. That averages out to 2 points per opportunity, which is about half of where they need to be. Like, I usually benchmark that around 4.25, somewhere in that range. Right. So, you know, those games, you know, you have to be able to finish drives, like, especially when you're playing with, you know, the ball control mindset where you're going to run the ball and it's working, you're being effective. When you're, you know, bleeding the clock down, you got to be able to finish those drives with touchdowns, even if it's just a couple of drives or one drive, and then be able to, you know, kick some field goals. But, you know, you're right. Efficiency in that area is a big factor. I mean, Iowa, they're one of the worst teams in that statistic. I think they're like 2.8 points per opportunity, which is like bottom five in the FBS. So it's like, it's always a battle of who's going to be just a little bit more efficient when they're able to get those scoring opportunities.
Yeah. Here's a weird theory too, that I hadn't thought of live on the air, but somebody brought it up to me today as we were just having an off the record discussion. When Callie McManus throws the interception, right? It's third and seven or so. And the Gophers, it is amazing. And this is something I'll ask you too. And this is nothing against Trey Potts or Bryce Williams, but it's amazing how much better this team runs with Mo. I mean, I know he's a good running back, but and it didn't seem last year to be as big of a drop off. Maybe the line was a little better, and maybe Trey Potts just was more comfortable with those carries. I know, but a couple drives got thwarted when he had to take himself out of the game, and the Gophers just couldn't gain yards. That said, on Callie McManus, so it's third and seven. Trey Potts has to come in on one of those plays, and they throw it on, which I think probably factored into the decision, right, to probably throw on third down. If that just drops incomplete, if Jack Campbell does what Terrell Smith did and it just bounces off his hands, then to me the theory was either go for it or you kick a long field goal, which would have been like 52 yards into the wind, which you can't do. I hadn't thought of it, but how much time was left there?
Punt it.
How much? Yeah, punt it, right? Punt it into the wind, pin them deep, get the ball back and kick a field goal to win it. That would have been really beating Iowa at Iowa's own game. So, again, it's just one of those weird things. If that ball just bounces off and flies 50 yards past like normal, like that, you know, it bounces up and Iowa had a guy there. And that is one thing. I know our buddy Burnsy's offended by the fact that Iowa keeps winning games this way and it can't be sustainable. It can't be sustainable. And I always say, look, if you're well coached and you're always in the right spot, you make plays like this. But those are just the weird things, and people are going to say, well, Grimm's just making excuses. But this is one of those games. Look, I thought last year there were things they could have done against Iowa. I thought this game plan was there, and just some funky stuff happened. And look, you punt there. You can punt there and maybe still win the game in regulation, right?
Well, yeah, you backed them up and punted in the previous situation, you know, where you said, all right, you know, go get a three and out, and then you're going to get good field position again. And that happened in the previous sequence.
And even after Moe's fumble at the nine, they get the ball back to set the drive up that ended in the interception.
But again, it all comes back to field position. When you're playing Iowa, you know they're always going to have a talented punter. They put the details into that. You know, they just reload at those specialist spots. Yeah. And when you're playing in these Big Ten West games where, you know, every game is close, you look at the numbers of how many games are decided by one score. You know, I'm amazed by that. And who scores first is such a big factor. Who can get off to a quick start? Like, all of those things matter. And Iowa is always very good at that. Like, coming out with the first play of the game with the screen, the middle screen to the tight end, you know, jet motion stretches the defense out. You know, you're sending pressure from the boundary and they run that screen right into it. And it sort of set the tone for the game, you know?
Yeah.
You're kind of slowing that pass rush down naturally because of the threat of the screen. And I just thought, you know, there were some good looks that they ran there, and they asserted themselves early, which was key.
And it gave Petras, who, as we mentioned, has not been very good, some confidence. I thought he actually played with some swagger more than I have seen in recent times with him. The other question I had, Wisconsin the week before against Iowa had six sacks. They pressured, they blitzed. What's the blitz percentage? Do you have that? What did Minnesota decide to do defensively? How often did they send an extra guy, or however you define a blitz? And was it more than you thought, less than you thought? What would you have thought there from that standpoint? Because I know late in the game they were rushing three actually a lot and dropping eight into coverage.
Yeah, the philosophy was, I mean, they dashed it in a little bit. I actually thought it was about what I was anticipating. I think it was around 19% total blitz in that game. So, you know, I thought maybe they'd mix in some, you know, simulated pressures where they, you know, drop a defender and send a second or third level defender from another spot, because Wisconsin did that a lot against Iowa. But I think some of the looks that they were getting, they were doing a really good job of defending the run, like the wide zone stuff. They were blading through blocks. They were getting penetration. They were setting the edge for the most part on the backside. Like, and then you get that very, very well-timed cat blitz from the corner, Terrell Smith, and Petras doesn't even see it. Like, I thought that was a huge play in the game. I thought that could be like a turning point moment. No. You know, they had just picked up that big play with that misdirection run. You could feel the flow of the game just kind of shifting a bit. And then they make that big play, and that sort of – I just thought this is a moment where Minnesota can take control of this game again.
Well, the radio announcer said it'd be a good time for a sack, so tee time must have listened. So I'm going to give credit to myself for getting tee time that one. So there you go. So you mentioned to me before we came on, you had about five plays that maybe define the game. I know we've talked about a few. What else – have we hit on all of them, or what other plays stand out to you?
Yeah, we hit on all of them. Yeah. I'd say those you know, turnovers, the third and one play, you know, sort of the sequence leading into that, the Oliver miss sack, you know, that I just think that was a that was a big play if you're able to convert there.
Yeah, I agree. No question. So they ended up, you know, the first half, I think Ethan was 6 of 7 or 7 of 8, something like that, just one incomplete. And then second half, they didn't have to throw much. And I was okay with that, especially, you know, people had said, well, you can't win against Iowa by what you did against Northwestern and Rutgers, but yet they were within an eyelash of doing it. What did you think? And then late, you know, he's just throwing desperation stuff and had 3 or 4 incompletes there to make him go, 1 for 8 or whatever. They just didn't throw much. What was your thinking on how aggressive? Like I said, if I was to nitpick, I'd say I would have cut the kid loose and shown his arm off and throwing 2 or 3 balls 50 yards downfield just to see what might happen against a defense that's used to only having to defend 15 yards because everyone's scared to do anything against him.
I liked some of the stuff I saw in the first half, like leak and melt in the flat, getting a high percentage completion, settling into the soft spot of the zone with Brevin, getting him the football. And, they ran a crossing route to Daniel Jackson, which created some conflict because Moe's route leaked out into the flat, off the play action, I believe. And then, it created just enough traffic and space that Daniel Jackson was able to flatten off the route. And, they were able to make that completion. And then hitting Lamecki, like you felt a flow on that drive, where I thought maybe in the second half, just coming out with, a couple completions, high efficiency completions, getting the ball out in space to maybe get, 5, 6, 7 yards. I'm not talking about taking deep shots, because I think the coverage that Iowa runs doesn't yield to, taking a ton of deep shots unless you're able to really scheme them up where, you're able to clear out defenders and then, vacate players and get into open space. So I didn't even feel like that was as big of a deal, but I thought, blend in a couple of quick hitting concepts in there to just sort of keep the rhythm going, because I thought that one drive where they were able to go right up the field, they blended between the run and pass very well there. And I thought it stretched some things out, gave the defense some different looks. But I also understand that personnel kind of plays into that. What do you feel comfortable doing with the receivers that you have, your quarterback that's got limited experience? Like, we're not up to speed on what the conversations are, but I do think moving forward into the future, being able to, dash in some quick hitters and some intermediate stuff in between that, I think that's what made the 2019 offense so good. It was either multidimensional. I don't even like to call it balance. I call it like, what is the defense giving you? Are they putting an extra hat in the box, which teams are doing to take away the run? Are you able to win vertically with speed and sort of put some stress on, or, get your guys going vertical and hit underneath? I think they were able to do that a lot off by, using play action and sort of building off of the run game. So that's the next step, I think, as they start to target personnel, maybe bring in a couple of transfer receivers, like looking ahead, that's the next element, being able to be fully multidimensional. So I feel like, the offensive staff is just trying to do what they can with the personnel right now.
Yeah. And be efficient at it, be efficient at both. And if you're efficient,
and it almost worked.
Yeah. And what have you. So, hey, I got to real quickly mention Affinity Plus. They're your local credit union, proudly serving Minnesota since 1930 and a proud sponsor of the Go Gopher podcast with Mike Grimm. As a current Gopher student, or if you're a proud Gopher alum, that makes you eligible to join this financial, wanting to build a meaningful banking relationship with you and put you first. You can meet with a local employee at any of their branches statewide, including right off campus in Minneapolis or anywhere else. You can learn more and find out other ways to connect by visiting affinityplus.org/gogophers. affinityplus.org/gogophers. Affinity Plus Federal Credit Union, federally insured by NCUA. We thank them for their support of Gopher Athletics, of the podcast. They also do so much for the state with the Special Olympics Minnesota, the Polar Plunge coming up. We'll have more on that in a podcast a little later on. All right, just a few minutes left with Daniel House, Gophers Guru. Daniel, tell us about your webpage for those that haven't learned about it yet. If not, why not? But if you haven't, here's what it's all about.
It's a subscription-based website where I kind of take a next-gen approach to football, educating fans on things that I look at, trends that I see, blending film and the numbers together, and then also doing features and different news stories just to keep fans informed, a unique way of Gopher football, and blending some basketball as well. So you can check it out. $5 a month is the subscription package.
How did you, I haven't asked you yet this on the podcast, or if I have, I've forgotten I asked you, how did your love for this kind of analytics and football come about?
I just have always looked at the game unique. Like, I started ball boying when I was in elementary school, and I did it with a Hall of Fame coach, and I just fell in love with the strategy of the game. Like, I go sit in there in third grade and watch the coach put stuff up on the board, and I would like ask, like, what does this mean? Like, what is this? So I learned about things, and then as I went on, I said, I'm so interested in how can you gain an edge? How can you do things differently? And the craze sort of started to hit, but then I said, I want to come up with some different ideas for how I watch the game. I watch it a little bit differently than people. So
yeah,
I have my own ideas. Some people might think they're crazy, but I do see some of it come to fruition. So it's something that I love to do. It's a passion of mine.
It's
so.
Great stuff. Gophersguru.com. I highly endorse it and encourage folks, particularly if you're Gopher fans, but if you're just football fans, it's an opportunity as well to learn about the game. It really is cool. And I'm a geek that way as well. I played football through the eighth grade, and that was it. And after that, I think I see the game, though, clearly in terms of, I don't know what, you know, chip blocks and defenses and some of that are, but I understand, you know, the game in terms of, oh, well, maybe they should go for it, or oh, maybe the play here is to punt, or maybe the play here is play action. They're cheating with extra guys in the box, and so I'm always fascinated by the numbers as well.
But you know, it always comes back to, Grim, you got to be able to blend the football instinct with that, and that's what I really value. Is, you know, you got to be able to also have the human element, the scheme side of it, but it gives you information to make better decisions and to look at the game through a different lens. So that's what I try to do, is strike that balance, you know?
Yeah, just as a very elementary example, for example, I wonder what models might say on that, let's say on the 8th and Callie McManus interception. So I don't even know if there's a model that says, oh, should you run or throw here in this situation? But if you just pour raw numbers in on that down 3rd and 7, it's probably, oh, you should throw. But that's against, I don't know if the raw numbers would indicate, it's against a team that is number one in interceptions in the last 6 years in the NCAA, right? So will raw numbers tell you that or not? And so that becomes a little riskier. And I think that's the blend, right, mm-hmm. that you're talking about. Like, okay, against a lesser defense, maybe this is the perfect throw. Against a team that leads the country in interceptions over the last 6 years, and I'm not questioning the throw. I'm doing this more, and I would have thrown that probably myself. I'm not questioning that part of it. I'm just using that as an example of you have to blend that a little bit to consider the raw numbers tell you something, but the flow of the game, who you're playing, how good you are at throwing the ball. If you have, you know, just a general, let's say it's some high school team that is starting a 10th grade quarterback that's never played, that model doesn't matter, right? I mean, you probably...
Right.
So that's the blend, and that's the beauty of it for sure. All right, so what do the numbers tell us about Wisconsin? Just a couple minutes left here with the Gophers guru, Daniel House. What do you see the Gophers needing to do Saturday in your home state of Wisconsin?
Yeah, well, I watched the film, looked at the numbers a bit, and, you know, I think this game is going to come down to, like it always does, first and second down. Who's more efficient on first and second down? The Badgers are a team that has to stay on schedule, run the football with Braylon Allen. You got to swarm. You got to be able to take him down. You can't arm tackle. Minnesota's done a very good job of this in recent years against him. So I would say being able to effectively defend the run and get Wisconsin into passing down situations. They're one of the worst teams in the FBS in a lot of categories once you get them into passing down situations. So I think that's key. And then Graham Mertz being able to apply pressure. Graham Mertz has completed 61% of his passes, 17 touchdowns and 5 interceptions from a clean pocket this year, versus 44% with 2 touchdowns and 4 interceptions while under pressure. So you look at the difference between him when he's in a clean pocket versus facing pressure. You got to be able to apply, good rush and get the pressure rates up to impact throws. I think on the other side of the ball, Wisconsin's defense has gotten better. I've noticed a huge difference since the return of Alexander Smith, their cornerback. I just think that Wisconsin, you always know that Jim Leonard's going to have a really good defensive scheme, you know, blending between the base 3-4 and some 4-down stuff. And then, you know, John Torchio, their safety, is a big weapon. They move him all over the place and do a lot of creative things to maximize his skill set. So, you know, I know he's going to come in with a scheme where they have simulated pressures and creepers and a lot of different things that will stress protection. So got to be able to protect very well. And then, like, I think the theme's been the same, Grim, where you got to be able to hit on those 5 or 6 key passing plays right now. Those ones that become available, you can't miss on it. You can't drop the ball. Like, you're going to have to make every single play that's presented to you and just be efficient. Continue to run the football, but also blend in the pass. And you know, it doesn't need to be vertical stretch necessarily all the time. I just think you got to stretch the defense out and make them defend every inch of the field.
Well, no one thought that the Gophers, even though they've been really efficient at running, could put 300 on Iowa, really good defense. Assuming a healthy Mo, you know, I know he came out late in that game. Let's assume he's healthy. What kind of success can they have running the ball against this Wisconsin defense?
Yeah, I know. You go and you look at the numbers. Like, I filtered the numbers out when Jim Leonard took over because I think it's a totally different team and you have some, you know, philosophical differences. But since that happened, they have the third best rush defense in expected points added per play. They're fifth in opponent rushing play success rate. Keanu Benton, I think, is one of the best DTs in the Big Ten right now. Will definitely be on a lot of draft radars. So I'm interested to see what the type of scheme is, especially if, you know, Nick Herbig's unavailable. It sounds like they might appeal that, but if he's out for the first half, he's one of their most dynamic weapons, top player in pressures, huge factor of what they do. But I believe, you know, you're going to have to, you know, continue to be creative with the ground scheme. There's subtle details every week that Minnesota puts in, you know, whether it's formationally, whether it's like with the split zone flow, like how they make their reads. And it makes it difficult for the defense to, you know, scheme for it. And they have to adjust in the game. So I think those are the details maybe that people don't notice. But Minnesota's done a nice job of making those subtle tweaks to help the run game. And then when you got Mo, who's just phenomenal at pressing the hole, waiting for those blocks to develop. Like, nobody can create space like him.
It's crazy.
I mean, it's not there, but he can do that. It's just, it's incredible. Gopher fans just need to appreciate and enjoy these the moments with Mo, because he's just sensational.
Well, and I thought against that Iowa team, So what Mo on that outside zone, and again, they have much, you know, different versions of that. What he over the years to me has always done is he just keeps running. And all of a sudden you're like, holy cow, he got 8 yards. Where did that come from? He just, you know, but what he did against Iowa was totally different. He would start it and then you say, I guess, press it or whatever and go against the flow almost. I couldn't believe Iowa could not figure it out. Huge holes. You know, it was amazing. I mean, he was off to the races three or four different times and, you know, a step or two away from touchdowns, which would have probably put the game away as well. But the way he pressed that and would cut back, and then there were times where he'd start the cutback and the backside guy would come in and he'd fake him out too and go. It was, I mean, what a game he had. It was just amazing against a great defense.
His feet. His feel, his instinct. I mean, the guy's running so hard, his face mask's falling off. Yeah. Like, I mean, you just can't even write a script better than that. Like, this guy leaves it all out on the field. That press conference after the game, like, watching him and what he poured into that game and the emotion of, like, 800-plus carries, 4 fumbles. Like, that guy wanted that game so bad.
Well, it's one of those deals. I know PJ talks about it. All you can do is say it's a lesson because, Mo deserved to have that game go as a win with how he played. And I thought the Gophers probably deserved the win, but Iowa made the 2 plays when they mattered, and there you have it. But, if there was justice in the world, Mo has a big game, and he gets to chop the goalpost down in Madison on Saturday. Let's hope that's the case.
Yeah, I thought the O-line played good too, Grim. I mean, yeah. We talk about Mo, but I believe this group's gotten better every week. Like, staying low, firing off the ball, getting movement, climbing into the second level. Like, this group, I felt like in the middle of the season, they were still trying to figure some things out as they adjusted to get to the Big Ten. But now that we're at this point where the season's progressed, I thought the last 2 weeks have been really good from that group.
Yeah, for sure. Well, hey, we appreciate it. GophersGuru.com, Daniel House with the breakdown of rivalry weeks last week with the Hawkeyes and this week with the Badgers. Daniel, give us the webpage again and all the info.
GophersGuru.com, and you can check out my work at Daniel House NFL on Twitter.
Awesome. Always appreciate it. I owe you lunch or something, all right?
All right. Well, we're going to get lunch. We're going to get lunch before basketball
game
or something. Let's do it.
Let's do it. Sounds good. There he is, Daniel House, the Gophers Guru. It's episode number 46, the Go Gopher Podcast with Mike Grimm. My thanks to the Gophers Guru, Daniel House, for his great insight on Gopher football and helping us understand the game a lot better. When we come back, we'll go behind enemy lines with the great Matt LaPay. The voice of the Wisconsin Badgers is next.
I'm Clay Geary, walk-on turned scholarship wide receiver for Gopher football.
And I'm Ben Utek, U of M alumni, Super Bowl champion, and Tony Dungy Uncommon Award winner.
We understand championship culture, which is why we're part of the True North family of companies.
True North invests in only elite teams, like the champion team at Sunbelt Business Advisors, Minnesota's largest seller of companies. To learn more about True North and our diverse family of independently owned companies, visit TrueNorthEquityPartners.com.
Hey Gopher fans, this is your State Farm agent, Tony Hoagland. We are super excited to be part of the new Mike Grimm Show on Talk North. For the year of 2022, we will be donating $10 to the University of Minnesota Children's Masonics Hospital for everyone that calls our office or checks in with us online and mentions that they heard about us on Talk North and the Mike Grimm Show. We are really excited again that Mike came on board with Talk North. You can reach us at 763-421-4900. You can find us on the web at champlininsurance.com. Again, 763-421-4900 or find us on the web at champlininsurance.com. Row the boat, Sky Uma, go Gophers.
Episode number 46. Welcome back. It's the Go Gopher Podcast with Mike Grimm. My pleasure to welcome to our program Matt LePay, the very fine play-by-play announcer of the rival Wisconsin Badgers. It's rivalry week, and Matt, I can't wait to get to Madison, Wisconsin. It's outside of the plush and ostentatious radio booth. Everything else is great about the trip to Madison.
It's nothing but five-star in that booth, right? So, no, looking forward to it. This is always my... if it's not my favorite game, it's pretty close to it. Just the rivalry and being split down the middle pretty much over the course of the history of this series. So, yeah, it's going to be good to see you guys again.
Yeah, we get you back a little bit by where we stick you for basketball, I guess, right?
kind of the end zone seats. But then again, visiting radio at the Kohl Center, you need binoculars to see basketball there. Yeah. So they might, the inside scoop, though. But you guys come to Madison for basketball?
Yes, I think we do in early January. Yeah,
you might kind of have a good news, bad news. You might be on the floor.
Oh.
But you might be close to Coach Johnson.
Oh,
so
nice.
Hopefully, I hope that's not a false promise I just gave. So I guess we'll find out together.
Unlike our mutual friend Gary Dolphin at Iowa, who needs to be on the floor, I actually don't mind the location in Madison because I'm more of a space guy when you work next to a 6'10" guy. So where we're at, now we're really getting inside scoop, but that's why people listen to a podcast, Matt. So here we go.
That's right.
So we get the visiting radio basketball broadcast team gets the home television hockey booth at the Kohl Center. So we're way up high, and it is a long ways away. And I do need glasses, so you can see that. I do usually pack the binoculars, but I like it because there's plenty of space. We go to some places, Illinois, they put you in about a 4-foot stretch for four people and all the gear. Our engineer packs like he's going to land a 747 every game, so it gets tight. So I actually don't mind the spot in the Kohl Center. It because of the space, it's a good bird's eye view. You don't have Ed Hightower standing in front of you blocking your view, and it's all right. It's all right by me.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that because I switched with a couple of guys who I knew just really didn't want to be upstairs, with vision issues or whatever, and I found the same thing. Space matters for us, Mike.
Yes.
And you can't spell media without M and E. So it's all about me at the end of the day. So yeah, no, I get where you're coming from.
Yeah, it's and as always, we I've already digressed into we're going to talk football and rivalry week and the Axe, and here we are talking about us as always.
No, do we have to talk football?
Yeah,
I thought
kidding.
We were just talking broadcast. I was going to ask you how Tollickson's golf game is coming along because this summer I had a great view of a guy who can hit it a million miles off the tee, who actually looks like he's played the game a little bit.
He can
really
play.
Irritating.
Yeah, he can play. He gets a little sporadic off the tee, but I suppose when you're sporadic at 330 yards off the tee, it's better than guys like you and me, where when we're sporadic, we leave ourselves with long second shots on occasion, and oftentimes second shots that aren't even playable. Spencer can hit it, no doubt. We did have a fun time down, several of us around the Big Ten. Again, our buddy Gary Dolphin hosted us for a little golf outing. Was that in May, I think, right?
I think it was, yeah. Middle of May.
That was a fun day. But, yeah, Spencer can hit it, can he? Yeah, it was. You were in his foursome.
I was. It was a good time. No, it was great. And we set aside the whole Wisconsin-Minnesota thing for the most part. You know, he'll get that in there every now and then, just how much he loves Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And particularly love former basketball coach Bo Ryan. He'll get that in there every now and then.
Yes.
But
yes.
That's all part of the fun of this thing.
That's all part of the rivalry. You know, you figure the rivalry. I know on our side here of the state in terms of Minnesota, I grew up in Iowa, so I was on, knew about that rivalry as well. But living now in the Twin Cities for 17 years, the Minnesota-Wisconsin rivalry, I think because
has, it includes hockey as well. And it, you know, literally, you know, 15 minutes even from where I live here in the Twin Cities is the border. You know, I can get to Wisconsin in about a 20-minute car drive. So that I think is the most intense of the Minnesota rivalries here in the Twin Cities amongst Gopher fans. Maybe you get south to Rochester and areas in southwestern Minnesota, it's Iowa. But I think here in the Twin Cities, that Wisconsin-Minnesota rivalry is the biggest. And I don't know what it is like in Madison.
No, I think it's much the same. I think, you know, mutually we all hate Michigan and Ohio State.
Yes. Right?
That's a given. But here's a for instance for you, Mike, and this one hit me between the eyes. This was, I want to say, you know, 10, 12 years ago. It was, we were having one of those summer golf outings with our, you know, our corporate partners, and I was talking to my supervisor because an old high school friend of mine who actually is a Michigan graduate, but he loves college football. He was saying, hey, you think you can get me tickets for a game? And thinking, which game? It was one of those years where Ohio State came to Madison. I thought, well, you know, let me check. Thank you. I've got several months' notice. So I asked the supervisor at the time. I said, hey, this is a tough one, but if you can't do it, let me know. But, you know, just looking to, you know, purchase a couple tickets, you know, hopefully relatively decent seats for the Wisconsin-Ohio State game. And he said, oh, we could do that. Just don't ask for Minnesota.
Wow.
That was the tougher ticket.
Yeah.
And that told me it just confirmed what I knew all along, the rivalry. And I mean, I grew up in Ohio, and when I first heard about Paul Bunyan's act, thinking, what the heck is this? And it doesn't take long. You know, the one time either, you know, your team wins it or their team wins it, and the parade lap, and you fake like you're going to chop down the goalpost, and you get caught up in it pretty quickly. Just even as a fan of the sport, it really is a true, genuine rivalry where I think there's a lot of mutual respect with players and coaches, not a lot of love,
yep.
But there's a lot of respect. Just the history of it and the close. You know, the closeness of the series we talked about, was it 62-61 with 8 ties?
Yeah.
That's a rivalry. That's not a hammer and a nail. That is a legit rivalry.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. You think it's the longest continuous played. Thank goodness we slid that 2020 game in there at the end to keep it going, because I think there is something to be said to keep it continuous, and it's within one game. That said, you know, there was a string there, 15 straight. You know, my first however many years here, it was going Wisconsin's way, and that was good for the Badgers. But it also, I think, in a weird way, was it fed the rivalry in Minnesota. Because as they say, absence makes the heart grow fonder. And every year that went by that the Axe did not at least reside in Minnesota for a bit made you want it even more. And it was weird because when the Gophers finally broke through in that 2018 game, that wasn't a particularly great Gopher team. It was PJ's second year. They got to bowl eligibility with that win. But it was treated around the state like they had maybe won the national title. And I know some outsiders looked at that as if it was, you know, geez, what are they doing? And I think you just had to understand what it meant to not have won that for 15 straight, and it tells you about the importance of the rivalry. And now, you know, it's 2-2 in the last 4 years, and I think that maybe not as good for Wisconsin, but for the rivalry itself, like you say, you can't be the anvil and the nail all the time. To have it be, you know, who knows who's going to win? It's a 2-point spread this week, right? That's probably better overall for college football, the Big Ten, and the rivalry itself.
Yeah, I think it brings in the casual fan. It brings in more casual fans to this game because, you know, look, and, you know, from 2010 to, you know, most of that decade, Wisconsin was really, really good. The problem was Ohio State went totally next level. But the, you know, the Badgers were, you know, winning division championships and trying to get back to the, you know, getting to the Big Ten title game. And at that point, dominating the series. But I do think, yeah, Mike, the last 4 years with it being split, last year Wisconsin going up to the Twin Cities with a chance to win the West and get back to the title game and losing, and the fans storm the field, you hear jump around. That's all that kind of stuff that, yeah, these players are being reminded of it this week.
Yes.
But what it really does, but to the casual fan, it's like, yeah, this is real. And you know, talk about Jim Leonard earlier this week about that. You know, he played 10 years in the NFL. He was, as a player, his team's won twice, lost twice to Minnesota. But he's a big believer in these trophy games and senior day and all that stuff that you don't get in the NFL, which is great, best players in the world. But it's more of a corporate setting, where in college, as corporate as it's getting, And with all the changes that we know are going on, there are still things that separate the college game from the NFL, and these in-season trophy games and the senior day, the emotion that goes with that. That's still, to me, and I think to millions of fans, that's still what makes college football a little extra special.
For sure. I mean, even think this game, just in general this week, you've got a 7-4 Minnesota who is, you know, playing for nothing more than maybe bowl pecking order. They're not in the mix for the West. Wisconsin 6-5, not in the mix. If it was just a normal, all right, it's just a Big Ten game, okay. But when you throw in Paul Bunyan's axe, it's the biggest thing going on right now.
My first year here was 1988, covering Wisconsin athletics, and that was a year where it was Don Morton's second year of three. The Badgers won one game that year, and it was a game with a, as we would say, had a face for radio. It was ugly. It was two teams that were really struggling. It was the only game Wisconsin won that year, but to see those guys, you know, there was this one player at Wisconsin named Jeff Weicker who grabbed the axe and I think really wanted to chop down the goalpost. It wasn't one of those fake love tap things. I think he wanted to take a full swing. You find out right away what the game itself means. And I know it's cliche to say throw out the record, but I think there's a lot of truth to it here. This can be, you know, both teams are going to play in bowl games, and that'll be a lot of fun for all those guys. You hope it is, that the whole bowl experience. But I think this is the game that these kids remember. I mean, you asked the Gophers from last year, a very good year for Minnesota. But if you could pick one game, my guess is that game against Wisconsin would be the one where you do something special on your home field against your arch rival. That's what college football gives you.
Yeah, no question. I mean, they won a bowl game, but they remember that Badger game on Thanksgiving week for sure last year the most of any of those games. There's 100% certainty there. All right, you brought up, Coach Leonard. It's been an interesting year for the Badgers and the program, a program that has been, you know, stable. Now, there's been some coaching changes, but it's all, you know, over the last, you know, couple of decades. But it's been, you know, kind of overseen by the architect of the whole powerhouse deal. How surprised were you that that the change happened when it did with Coach Crist and Coach Leonard, and kind of what do you see since within the program, Matt?
Well, I guess, you know, to answer the question about surprise, my wife and I were at a friend's house on that Sunday evening. We were ready to have dinner. We were, you know, maybe pouring a glass of vino, and all of a sudden my phone was blowing up, and the vino went right back into the bottle, and I went down to campus to be there for the formal news conference. So. I think it was a jolt to a lot of people. And Mike, what I tell folks is that the hard part for me, and you know, you being an announcer, you can relate to this because you know the principals more than most, and you work with them closer than most. And in this case, I have great admiration professionally and personally for Paul Crist, who I've known since my first year around here in 1988. Chris McIntosh, great admiration for. I've considered him a friend as well. And Jim Leonard, all of those guys. So it'd be a lot easier if there was somebody you didn't like, but you like all of them. So it stung in the moment. I know I've talked with Paul. He's going to be fine. You know, everything is good, but it's still a jolt when it happens. So it's you're right. There have been coaching changes here. Twice coaches have left right after Big Ten championship games. And then Barry Alvarez stepped in as an interim for their bowl games. But an in-season change, that's usually the thing that happens somewhere else, but it got close to home. So how have they changed? I think they've, you know, you can only change so much in the course of a season, Mike, but I think this team, and it's not to say that they were rolling over before, but they've shown a ton of fight here, and the recency bias to that statement was last Saturday at Nebraska. And we know the Huskers are not what they once were as a program. But, you know, Wisconsin is down 14-3 going in the fourth quarter. They were making mistakes, which has been the kind of thing that's been hurting this team this year and really for the last couple of seasons. They were moving the ball well, and then they would do just enough on their own to stall the drive, a key penalty, whatever it was. And I didn't really, in my own mind, give them much of a chance in the fourth quarter. But they rallied in that game, and they won that game. And I'm not sure earlier in the year if they would have done that. Against a Washington State team early, it was there for them to win. They didn't do it. And this past week against Nebraska, in, as you know how cold it it was last weekend. It wasn't exactly balmy down in Lincoln. They fought through it. They found a way to get the ball in the end zone twice. The defense is playing as well as it has all season. So I'm not going to say the offense is great yet, but I think it has shown some more promise with the, last week, not great. Iowa, not great. You saw firsthand how good Iowa's defense is. But they have shown, I think, a little bit more for the most part in recent weeks than what they had shown prior to the coaching change as well. But be interesting to see how all this ends up and what further changes will be made moving forward to try to get this offense cranked up, because it's been a while since this offense has been at close to the caliber they want it to be.
Yeah, and from that standpoint, when the move was made, there was a lot of thought, and obviously you're closer to it, and maybe you have to be careful with what you say. But do you foresee that Jim Leonard is the front runner here to be handed the reins to the program that he has devoted so much time to here?
Yeah, it's being careful to not state something that I don't know for sure, Mike. I think a lot of people assume that that's going to happen. I think I've learned not to assume much here.
Right.
As I've said, I'd be all for it because I'm a big fan of Jim Leonard. But what I don't know, and what really, 99.9% of us don't know, is who else is engaged, who might really be attractive has reached out, what kind of conversations are going on. So I guess the beauty of our position is we don't have to chase this down.
Yes.
We just wait for the announcement. We react to it accordingly. So, like I said, if it's Jim, I'd stand and applaud. But I guess I'm like most. I'm in a wait-and-see mode. And they'll tell me when they think I need to know.
That's how we live our life, no doubt.
That's right.
As for the game Saturday, it's interesting because there's so many, I think, similarities when you look at Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Iowa. That trio of teams, how they play good defense, all of them top 10 kind of style of defenses here for a couple of years now. And you mentioned it, we saw last week that game plan I thought P.J. Fleck put together, even though he's been kind of getting killed here locally a little bit in terms of being too conservative, was really, I thought, the game plan to beat Iowa. They had to be patient, and they were positioned at the 11-yard line with about 5 minutes to go, and a guy who's fumbled three times and 824 carries coughs it up, and Iowa makes two forces two turnovers and do what they do. And even when stuff doesn't go Iowa's way, it's amazing with their defense. Jack Campbell should have had a pick six, it looked like. They said he stepped out. Replay showed he didn't. Had he not, in retrospect now, it's all hindsight, had he not stepped out and just gone and scored, Minnesota might have had three and a half minutes to try to go tie it. But he doesn't step, but they call him out. They make a beautiful play to a tight end. They set up the field goal. They milk the clock to 25 seconds, and basically the game's over. So even when stuff doesn't go their way defensively, it kind of does go their way, and that's how it's been. And Wisconsin's been good defensively. Minnesota's been good defensively. Last week, I think the Minnesota-Iowa game, Matt, was the lowest over-under on a college football game in betting history at 32. And I don't know what this week's is. I don't bet, not because I'm against betting. It's just I don't have money, and the little bit I do, I would lose. So I just decide not to bet. I do follow it, though, just because I think it offers a baseline. Those numbers are meaningful. Those guys know what they're doing, so just as a baseline. So 32, I remember talking to Dolph before the game. I said, if I was betting, I think I'd take the under, and it would have been right. And I don't know what the under is this week, but I'm taking it if I was betting.
Yeah, I think, but as I tell people, points will be at a premium. Every point will be precious in this game. Been saying that the last couple of weeks with Wisconsin. To tag your earlier point, though, about that last game, it when you have that many touches and that few lost fumbles, you have to think what happened was a fluke. I mean, credit Iowa for making a play, but Mo Ibrahim is a stud. I mean, as Jim Leonard said, it's time for him to move on. He's seen enough of him. But you think about that, Mike, even after the fumble, it was a bang-bang play. I'm not going to fault the kid for not coming up with the interception, but there, Petras throws a pass that gets tipped, and was it Terrell Smith?
Yeah.
It got to him like right now. Would have been a heck of a play if he'd have made it.
But it hit him in the hands.
If it hits him in the hands, he gathers it. Either goes in, or they give it to Mo Ibrahim in the next one, two, or three plays later, he's in, the whole thing changes, and then the game plan looks great. Columnists are saying, boy, this was a great approach. Yeah. You got your defense where you wanted it. We all know how that works. I thought, you know, I was watching that on the way back from Lincoln and rewatching it here in the last day or so. It just shows you how, you know, the beauty of this sport. Because we all love the 45-42 type of game, the USC-UCLA game of the weekend. But I thought it was a heck of a game, the Iowa-Minnesota game. Because you had two teams that, I mean, that was, you call it turn back the clock, Big Ten football, whatever. But it's cold, it's windy, you know, it's miserable. But those guys are out there flying all over the place. And, I mean, Ibrahim, I've told people up here that Mo Ibrahim, he's got a Ron Dane workload right now. You look at the last five games and the 34, 35 carries a week that he's had. That's what they did with Ronnie back in his time at Wisconsin. The difference is Ron was bigger than Ibrahim. Whatever he's listed at, he runs like he's about 240. What are they listing at? Like 210?
5'10", 210, I think is what he's listed. Yeah.
But he has that battering ram way about him that would appear to make him seem much bigger. So, I mean, a ton of, and, you know, running behind an offensive line that almost makes Wisconsin's look small in some ways. But the similarities between the programs, you're right, fundamentally sound, run the ball, stop the run, field position, don't make a lot of mistakes. And as Leonard said earlier this week, the difference in last year's game, Minnesota was the more physical team. I would imagine the Badger players have been reminded of that quite a bit.
I would say a challenge has likely been issued from the Badger coaching staff on that. And even last week, Iowa-Minnesota, I thought Minnesota, well, clearly for much of the last three quarters of that game, Minnesota was the more physical team, which is saying something because that Iowa defense is so good. But yet it was Iowa with its usual timeliness of making plays. And people here have always talked about, you know, that Iowa thing that's a 4 or 5 year deal now where they've just gotten interceptions and turnovers at timely thing, and it's like, is that sustainable? And it's like, look, if you're well coached and you're always in the right spot, you're gonna have people make plays. And then I also think opposing coaches sometimes do get into this mindset of, ooh, you can't make a mistake against Iowa, which then only plays into their hands more because they don't have to worry about deep balls and they don't have to worry about trick plays and they don't have to worry about, you know, they don't have to worry about maybe 15 yards of the field to defend. That's it. And so even the pick six that Mertz threw, you know, I'm sure when the Wisconsin coaches called that play, they're like, oh, well, this is a risk-averse safe play, but they don't have to worry about the deep pass because coaches are scared to do it. And so it's a pass, 2 yards past the line of scrimmage, it turns into a touchdown. The one pass Mertz threw deep was a touchdown, right, in that play in Iowa City. So Iowa does do that to people, there's no doubt.
Iowa's longest scoring drive against Wisconsin was 27 yards. That led to a field goal. It was like 18 yards, 17 yards, the pick six, and then a 27-yard drive that led to a field goal. So that's what Iowa does to you. And I think Wisconsin allowed, I don't even think it was 150 yards total offense in that game. Didn't matter. They got beat by two scores. That's what Iowa does. And I guess as, you know, Badger fans, Gopher fans, you have to grudgingly tip your cap to Iowa because they were the program everybody was laughing at. Can't get out of its own way offensively. And now, barring an upset and, you know, Purdue, I would like Purdue's chances against Indiana. I wouldn't like Nebraska's chances against Iowa, but that's the only way that Iowa doesn't get back to the Big Ten championship.
Crazy. So,
not fun to say, but facts are facts.
Facts are facts. And you're right. Everybody, you know, a month ago, that would have been speaking of betting, that would have been a terrible bet. You would say, oh, Iowa would have won the West. And it looks like that bet would probably be a winning ticket now. And on top of it, I tried to count it up. This is an unofficial count. The last drive that they had against Minnesota was, I think, a 43-yard drive after the interception return. And if I counted it up right, I think it was either the 13th or 14th scoring drive Iowa's offense has this year of 44 or less yards, right? They have one scoring drive of minus 4 yards. They returned it, lost 4 yards, and kicked a field goal. I think that was the Illinois game. And one of the Illinois games, one of the drives in Illinois, I think they went in, and we can joke about it, but they're the ones with the last laugh playing at Lucas Oil next week. But I think one of the drives at Illinois, they had it like first and 10 at the 22 and ended up with like a fourth and 38 back at near midfield and had to punt. So, but their defense certainly gets it done. The other thing about that game last week, I think the cold had something to do with it. I think the officials were freezing and said, we're just going to get out of here. No penalties on either team. First time since 1986 is what we were told this week, that a Division I football game went without penalties. I do believe there was probably something to do with how cold it was, and the refs are like, unless it's egregious, we're getting the heck off this field because we're freezing. But that's still a pretty cleanly played game, and really that's one of the other hallmarks, I think, with the three programs, that there's some similarities in how they play, but they're also all pretty disciplined over the years.
And that, it's been one of the differences with this Wisconsin team this season. It's been a little bit better here in these last couple of weeks, but even last week, you know, the penalty total wasn't dramatically high, but they were really ill-timed. One near the goal line, there was a targeting penalty that, you know, Wisconsin disagrees with, but a penalty it was. And then right after that, there was a late hit on the quarterback. But Wisconsin, you know, we see Minnesota, and I try to tell fans here, because obviously PJ Fleck is polarizing outside of the state of Minnesota. I said, you know, think what you will, but their teams don't get a lot of penalties against them. They play a very disciplined brand, and the best Wisconsin teams have been along those lines. But this year, they're in the 100s, the low 100s in penalty yards per game. And you know, I think of a couple of games that they've lost this season. That's been a major factor. And in the last maybe couple, 3 years, more penalties than usual against a Wisconsin team. Where the Badgers have been pretty good is their turnover margins of +3. They protected the ball better. Graham Mertz has been better this season than he has been in the previous two. There's still, you know, he's gotten away with some throws, but he's thrown a couple picks. We talked about the Iowa game. But that penalty stat is something that has stung Wisconsin a bit, and you just can't help but note it. But notice how clean the Gophers have been in regards to not committing penalties.
Well, I've already kept you longer than I promised, but you're so fascinating, I had to keep you a little long. So I appreciate it.
Matter, I was extremely windy today, even by my own windy standards.
Man, you get a couple Big Ten radio guys going, and who knows how long it can last, right?
Exactly. Well, I look forward to seeing you and Daryl and everybody up or down here in Madison this weekend.
Can't wait to get there. Always fun. Look forward to seeing you. Thank you, Matt.
All right, Mike. Take care.
All right. There he is, Matt LePay, episode 46, the Go Gopher podcast. My thanks to 11-time Wisconsin Sportscaster of the Year, Matt LePay, for giving us the scoop on Badger football. We enjoyed that conversation. My thanks also to Gophers guru Daniel House. I hope you enjoyed listening to the Go Gopher podcast, episode 46, as much as I enjoyed hosting it. Our Go Gopher podcast is presented by Sunbelt Business Advisors and True North Mergers and Acquisitions. If you're buying or selling a business, visit Sunbelt Minnesota.com or TNMA.com. We're also partnered with Affinity Plus Federal Credit Union, a locally member-owned, full-service financial invested in you. You can learn more at affinityplus.org/gogophers. They have a top-ranked mobile app as well. And we're also sponsored by State Farm agent Tony Hoagland. Again, I'd invite you to listen to past podcasts, and please be sure to subscribe right now to the Go Gopher podcast. It's free to listen at any time, and please promote the podcast on your social media channels so others can listen. We'll talk again next week.